Hello, and welcome to the Resilient Life Podcast. Resilient Life is part of peakprosperity.com. It's where we focus on practical and actionable knowledge for building a better future. I'm your host, Adam Taggart. With major hurricanes in our immediate past, present, and future, the topic of how to prepare for a natural disaster is an extremely timely one. The right advanced preparations can literally mean the difference between life and death. And of course, hurricanes aren't the only reasons to prepare for an emergency. As emergencies can be naturally caused, like a flood, tornado, or earthquake, or man-made, such as a financial crisis, social unrest, or war, everyone listening to this podcast has a vested interest in taking steps today to reduce their vulnerability should one of these unfortunate events occur where they live in the future. So to make sense of which steps are the most important to take soonest when preparing for a major disaster, we've invited Matthew Stein back on the program. Matthew is a design engineer, green builder, and author of the two best-selling books, When Disaster Strikes, A Comprehensive Guide to Emergency Planning and Crisis Survival, and When Technology Fails, A Manual for Self-Reliance, Sustainability, and Surviving the Long Emergency. Matthew is a graduate of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, otherwise known as MIT, where he majored in mechanical engineering and was the recipient of the Straight T Award, MIT's highest athletic honor. He has presented his expertise in disaster preparation on numerous radio and television programs and is an active mountain climber, as well as a guide and instructor for blind skiers. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today. We have a lot to dig into. Are you ready?
Sure. It's a pleasure to be back on the show with you, Adam.
Well, thank you very much.
Always great to be on your show.
Well, you know, Matt, for those who haven't heard you on the show before, can you give our listeners a little background into how you came to become an expert on emergency preparation?
Well, I came to this kind of from an unusual way. I'd never considered myself to be a survivalist, and I'd been concerned, ecologically concerned, with the trends in the planets back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But back in 1999, I'd been, actually 1997, I'd been praying and meditating, and which I did on a fairly pretty much daily basis, and I generically asked for guidance and inspiration, and I received a pictorial storyboard outline, kind of like how a director or producer will have people sketch out pictures describing scenes in a movie. So I received an outline for a massive book dumped into my head instantaneously. Now, to be honest with you, it was a huge shock. I'm a mechanical engineer, bachelor of science from MIT. I never considered writing anything remotely like this. And I'd written a few trade journal articles, you know, technical types of things, but nothing like this, and never even thought of writing anything like this. And here I get this project dumped in my lap. But essentially what was sketched out for me was a book to help people live more sustainably and more self-reliantly as our world goes through massive changes and upheavals. And realized that when I received this outline, it was in 97 when the world was going along really great. You know, dot-com was booming. Business in America couldn't be better. Oil was at a 30-year low when you factored in inflation. And it seemed on the surface that, you know, our world was doing just fine. It even looked like the Middle East was going to be resolved peacefully. It was before the Second Intifada had started. So to receive this semi-apocalyptic project dumped in my lap was really a rude shock and rude awakening. But as I did the basic research for my book, I found that the natural systems of our planet that maintain life as we know it, and including our weather systems, our food systems, the systems in the oceans that keep the oceans healthy, I realized that all of these natural systems are being stressed beyond sustainable levels and are headed for collapse if we didn't do something significantly different. And in the 20 years now that have passed since I received this sort of vision, we really haven't done anything to slow down the degradation of these natural systems, and they've actually accelerated and gotten far worse than they were 20 years ago. So time is ticking, and the world is still not waking up that we've got to make these changes. So that's how I became worried and concerned, and naturally the events of the last 20 years have only added to my level of concern.
Well, your perspective meshes pretty precisely into the same one that we share here at Peak Prosperity. And sadly, we agree with you that I think so many of the reasons why you wrote or entered into this this line of work are only more expressed now as we're further along in the timeline and things have only been accelerating. I also should mention too, I'm looking at my bookshelf here and I'm seeing what I believe you're referring to as that first major opus of yours, which is When Technology Fails. And it is a, I can give a personal testament. It has a spot of honor here on my bookshelf and has been a very valuable resource for me. Whatever dumped that into your head, I'm very appreciative for it.
Well, it gave me the outline, but I had to do the work. So it was a 3-year project for the first edition that published in around Thanksgiving of 2000, and about 2 years of labor, a year of lost wages, and then I put another year of labor and lost wages into updating in 2008. So what you're seeing there had at one point had more than all the equity of my home into it, and and 3 years of my life. Certainly have gone into that, and so I did the best I could to put down on paper what had been shown to me instantaneously in a vision, what must be described as some kind of vision.
Well, I think I speak for all of us who are owners of that book. We're appreciative of the risk you took, the great risk you took to put that out there, because I think you've helped a lot of people with that guidance, and hopefully we're going to help more on this podcast. And before I get to talking specifically about hurricanes, in my intro I gave a brief nod to the universal importance of having a plan and supplies put away in advance for emergencies, just in case. Do you care to comment at all at a high level about the importance of preparation in general before we get specifically to hurricanes?
Well, I think it's really critical in this time. We just don't know what it's going to be, whether there's going to be a pandemic, whether there's going to be, somebody, probably Pakistan, a bomb will get sneaked out of there, but an EMP attack on the United States is highly likely. A solar storm that wipes out our grid for many months to many years is a 1 in 8 chance every decade, the scientists say, and we've got a, it's been 9.5 decades since the last one of that magnitude hit the planet back in 1921. It was only 6 decades before that to the Carrington event in 1859. So we all, no matter where you live in the country, the scenario of all of a sudden one day not being able to go to Costco and not being able to fill up your car at the gas pump is an extreme likelihood. We just don't know when. It's going to happen. Most of us feel like it's going to happen in our lifetimes, and so being prepared and developing a plan and starting small, starting simple. And my newer book, When Disaster Strikes, basically it is a really comprehensive survival and prepping guide. So it kind of lays it out in simpler, clearer form than the massive book, When Technology Fails, so that if you really want to walk through that and start getting yourself together as far as being prepared, and it gives you peace of mind. Preparedness like car insurance. Nobody I know who has insurance says, "Wow, I'm insured. I want to get in a head-on collision today." It's like, if we never use that insurance, great. Okay, so the insurance company's made some money, and we never got to use it. That's terrific. You win, right? If you don't use your insurance, you win. And having the insurance of an emergency plan, a 72-hour survival kit. As you can build up to have things that can last you, several months of food stored, and a game plan for long-term collapse if you've got the ability to start working on that. If that day comes, you'll thank God that you spent the time doing it. And if it never comes, you'll thank God it never came, right?
No, exactly. It's funny. I just read a piece the other week that talked about made the same analogy for preparing as insurance, and as you said, what it gives you peace of mind, you don't have to feel bad if you never have to use it. In fact, you should feel great, as you just said. The other point I made around that is, insurance only has value if you buy it before you need it.
That's right. That's right. In California, I live in earthquake country, and once you have a significant earthquake in your area, you can't go out and buy insurance. You can't say, "Oh, wow, we had a 5.5 today, and a bunch of windows broke. Maybe I'll buy my insurance. It's like, no, that's too late. You're cut off at that point. Just like, hey, today I heard that Richard Branson and Donald Trump's giant mansions down in, I think, St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands were destroyed. And so, rich or poor, it can hit anyone and everybody. Now, naturally, Richard Branson and Donald Trump can much more afford it than you and I can. But the it you know disasters, catastrophes, they can be great levelers between the rich and the poor. And it's really who's prepared and who's not prepared matters more. And just having money does, if you don't put that money to good use ahead of time, it doesn't mean you're going to be any more protected than the other guy.
That's a very good point. Something else you said just reminded me of a conversation I was having the other day where, we could have had the same conversation 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and I'm sure coming into the conversation would be the just-in-time nature of our modern economy and way of life, where we have something like less than a 48-hour supply of most key medications, in most towns, and it's not that much longer for food at the grocery store. It's highly efficient, but it's not very resilient. Over the past 5 years, we've had the explosion of really convenient home delivery and e-commerce out of the home, largely driven by Amazon. Where for most people, most of what they buy these days, they buy online and it magically shows up at their house, a couple days later. And I don't think we really appreciate now, while that's wonderfully convenient, how vulnerable that makes us if we enter into a period where, all of a sudden those, as Chris calls them, the big brown trucks of happiness, stop showing up on your doorsteps.
I like that. I haven't heard that line before, but I do like that. Yeah, the big brown trucks of happiness. Yeah.
Yeah, but
Oh
we're
boy,
just
another
increasingly
toxic thing.
dependent upon that as a distribution of system for our needs, but it's highly disruptible given one of the many different potential disasters you listed off earlier.
Well, the grocery stores aren't far behind. They typically work on a 3-day turnaround now. So when I was a kid, all of the cities across the country had giant warehouses on the outskirts, and they had pretty much a 30-day supply of critical supplies on hand. And now it's pretty much a 3-day supply, is what I've heard in town. And you're saying it's actually even less. You're saying 2 days of critical medicines. And so, yeah, it's all coordinated by the internet, and everything is on trucks. So what you buy on Friday in the store was on a truck coming from somewhere on Monday. And so that system, when it goes down, yeah, it works great when everything's there. But when it's disrupted, then it's really what you and your friends and neighbors have on your shelves and your cupboard is what is what, or what you can forage for in your backyard or your vicinity is what you're stuck with for who knows how long. Some of these scenarios could be months to years. I mean, I hope that never happens, but it probably will within my lifetime, and maybe sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and that's actually really sobering because I think probably most people listening to this podcast have, been without power for, maybe a weekend, some maybe a week or a couple of weeks. If you live somewhere a little bit more rural after a big natural event like a hurricane or whatnot, but I don't think anybody, or I would posit to say very few people listening have ever been without. The modern amenities of our current society for more than a month, except by choice. Maybe people who wanted
Right.
to go live in a cabin somewhere or go take a remote trip somewhere as a life experience. But I don't think any people have lived that type of forced hardship. So if you see a good probability of that happening somewhere in the country in your lifetime, that's something that I think we as a modern society are just very unprepared for. Something maybe our great-great-grandparents, maybe experienced on a relatively routine basis in their lives, but it would be very, very foreign, I think, to most people in America today.
Yeah, I have an interesting perspective from my in-laws. My father-in-law grew up in he was born during World War I in Holland, and he was the 13th of 13 children, and his parents were killed in a bombing shortly
Oh, wow.
afterwards. And so he was raised by a sister. And then in World War II, he was on a border town with Germany. And so he was a resistance fighter, and he saw everything fall apart and people starve and people dying right and left. And he was captured and tortured. So a very different perspective. Then post-World War II, his neighborhood near where he was all bombed out. And he ended up in the Indonesian Revolution as a trained Dutch Marine. And my mother-in-law grew up in Indonesia, and so she talks about, looking out the back and seeing bodies floating down the river and guns, and she was shot through the chest at one point and had a 9-day, and people were starving and they were on rations. So it's a very – people who went through those kinds of times in other countries have a very different perspective, as I'm sure the Syrian refugees do in today's era, and people from – sub-Saharan Africa and places where there's all kinds of conflict. But I see the natural trends in our world are going to bring it home to America. I just don't see how we can avoid it. I think that our wealth and our power will not be able to insulate America from these kinds of shattering circumstances as the climate shifts. I think you're just seeing a tip of the iceberg with the current storms, that what you're seeing in hurricanes Harvey and Irma, instead of being a once in 500 year storm, they may be a once in 5 year storm, and then they may be an every year kind of storm, and that storms that far dwarf them might become, the big storms every 5 years. I just think that we're going to see the extremes in our planet go off the chart, and the number of refugees, eco and war-torn refugees from around the world searching for a place to survive and raise their families in relative peace, are just going to overwhelm the countries that aren't totally shattered, will be shattered by the refugees. So it's an interesting time we live in, and difficult times often bring out the best in people, and they bring out the worst in some, but they tend to bring out the best in most. That people pull together and help each other out, and the kinder, gentler heart shines through. And I think we're going to see an awful lot of those times, and a lot of bringing out the best in many and the worst in some.
Well, I actually really like that, and I want to flag for us to return to that near the end of the podcast, if we will. But I like that. It can bring out the worst in some, but it usually brings out the best in most. I really like that, and I think it's correct. And I also just think it's a way to look at preparation for some of these disasters that, as you say, are probably just mathematically inevitable, and look at them without, with something more than just complete abject fear. So with that said, let's switch gears now to talking specifically about the hurricanes that are battering the U.S. right now. We just had Harvey in the Gulf, and it really did a huge number on Houston and parts of Louisiana. But more specifically, I think I'd like to start talking about Irma, which up until a few days ago, I think was registered as the most powerful hurricane that had formed in the Caribbean, or at least entered the Caribbean. I think it's now down from a Cat 5 to a Cat 4, but still a highly powerful and destructive hurricane. And it looks like it's expected to hit Florida sometime Sunday morning. And for the record, folks, it's Friday afternoon as Matt and I are recording this. So these people don't have a lot of time to prepare, Matt, 48 hours from now, and probably most of them won't even hear this podcast until the storm is hitting or after the storm. But with 48 hours in advance of a major disaster at this point, what should those folks be most focused on in terms of prioritizing their actions?
Well, if they can't, if they're in a really vulnerable area, then focused on getting whatever supplies they can into their car and getting out of the area, or flying. Evacuation is the most important. Say you can't evacuate or you don't feel the need to evacuate, then a really big one is going to be filling while the public water system is still working and still providing clean potable water, to fill up your bathtubs, to fill up your sinks, to fill up garbage cans, to fill up anything you can with water. That's going to be a big one. Naturally, if you planned ahead, you really want to have the ability to purify water on the fly. A lot of people want to stay hunkered down where they are, but if they have to leave where they are, if the building they're in is breaking up and they have to leave, then they're going to have to leave. So if they can have a backpack ready with critical things, so what you need to think about is a minimum of 3 days for yourself and your family of food, water, portable shelter, meaning rain gear, protective clothing, whatever you think you need, medicines, everything you need. Think also about critical documents. If you haven't stored documents offsite somewhere, at least copy them onto a flash drive or something you can bring along with you, in case everything you have is wiped out. Hopefully, you've done something like Carbonite, where you're backing up all of your documents online and in the cloud. I things like that, I like to have multiples. I like to have hard copies sent away and shipped away to a friend out of town. I like to have electronic copies stored on site outside of my computer in case, like it burns down or somebody, I come home and find that somebody broke into my house and stole all my stuff. And think about the things you need to put your life back together again if you have to leave everything behind. I refer to it, it's been referred to as my life in a box. And I adopted that from somebody else, but some of the things is your birth certificates, social security cards, alien cards, copies of driver's licenses, medical and immunization records, marriage certificates, military papers, ownership and registration papers, RVs, cars, etc., living trust, wills, just the stuff that you, if everything went away and you had a box of this stuff, you could maybe put, a significant portion of your life back together. So, hopefully that never happens, but I had friends who were in Hurricane Iniki on Hawaii, on Kauai, 175 miles an hour, super Cat 5. And they were just arrived. It was the beginning of their vacation. It's like good choice of places to go. It's like, oh boy. And they were in there for 9 hours as that jet engine roar was going. And one lady was just sitting there scrubbing the grout between the tiles in the shower with a toothbrush, trying to take her mind off things. And they're watching. They were several rows back from the ocean front, and they watched all of the houses in front of them break up and blow by them and float by them. And when it ended, their place was still there. But all those people in the other houses that didn't drown or die, or had to leave, their houses were gone. They were gone. So, if that happens, and I know it's kind of late, but it's if you can get a dry bag for your 72-hour kit. Those are like river guide bags. Those are what they're sort of packs that roll up at the top and have kind of a giant paper clip that goes over them. And the river guides use them in whitewater rafting, and they keep everything totally dry in there. And so a dry bag for your 72-hour kit allows you to, wade through the river, use it kind of as a flotation device, sort of like grab onto it like a little floaty barrel. And move if you have to, and your stuff inside there will stay dry and not be destroyed. So these are just some of the things to consider. The aftermath is something else to consider, is that if when you survive, after surviving through the hurricane or the earthquake or disaster, it may, wherever you live, it may not always be a hurricane, then how do you deal with perhaps weeks, perhaps in some cases months, where there's no potable water and no sewage systems operating? And can you keep yourself healthy under those conditions? And can you purify water so that you don't poison yourself with every drink you take? So, these are all significant concerns and things to worry about.
All right, so let's get to that aftermath in just a moment here. But so let's say the people in Irma, or I think it looks like about a week after Irma, we might even get another hurricane, Hurricane Jose, which has already formed in the Gulf, but or formed in the Caribbean, but unclear yet whether it's going to make landfall or go off to sea. But assuming it does make landfall, when the storm is actually there. You mentioned a little bit about your friend there in the Kauai hurricane, but do you have any tips for people about what to do to ride out the storm in the greatest safety if you couldn't evacuate and just have to hunker down?
Okay, well, definitely fill up any containers and bathtubs and things you can with water. Tape off the toilets. Make sure nobody flushes a toilet, because there's a couple, you can't drink out of the toilet itself, but the toilet tank has a couple of gallons usually in it of really good water in there. And it was 3 weeks before water and power were restored in Kauai. And it was, the authorities, everything was like overloaded. And my friend David Rooley, he worked for the public utility district and the water people. So he was very smart about storing a bunch. And a lot of families used the water that he stored in those hours before everything got shut off and broken. Staying away from windows, flying glass, getting all of like lawn furniture, limbs off the trees, anything that might be a lethal
Projectile?
blowing
Yeah.
projectile. Yes, try to minimize those projectiles around your home, and then try to be aware that those projectiles, if it's 150 mile an hour winds, that things will be flying around that can they will certainly go right through windows, but can even go through stud walls. And that your stud walls, if you're not behind a concrete wall, that things like wood stud walls, may well just go away. And so you have to have a contingency plan if you're in a stud framed home and it's that high of a winds for getting out of there. And I mean, hopefully you're never in that situation, but you have to be aware that that might be it. You might have to just pick up at one moment and go and look for the nearest, safest, best, next best, safest place to be. So,
Which I'm guessing you'd recommend sort of do your best to predict in advance what that's going to be. In other words, pick your location B if location A suddenly becomes unsafe.
yeah, totally, totally correct. Pick your location B if location A. For example, I had friends in Black Friday in Australia. They were some ski people I knew in Tahoe, and their parents were aging, and they decided to leave Tahoe, where they lived for 15 years, 20 years, and move back to Australia. And it was 118 degrees outside, and a hot wind was blowing, and it was super, super dry. And they looked outside. There was no sirens, no warning, and they saw this massive mile-high plume of smoke, like right over the hill. So they just grabbed their dogs and their computers and a few, quick items, and threw them in their car and left for a friend's home that had was more defendable than theirs, where their friends had more grasslands around them, and they had a little pond, they had firefighting equipment, a little tractor. And they spent the night at their friend's place battling the blaze around their friend's place and protecting it until about 5 in the morning. They were finally able to get some sleep. Then they went back hoping to see their home, and they got around the corner, and the blaze had been so hot that they had an adobe brick-walled home with a metal roof, and all that remained was one wall.
Well,
The metal roof was melted. His bicycle tools, he was a bike mechanic, were melted. And nothing could have, there was no way. In that firestorm, 400 people in their town died, and in the area. And people were found incinerated in their cars, and 95% of his town was burned down. Luckily, he had a coffee roasting company, and like the shack, the shed that the coffee roaster was in did not burn down. And so they were really, they at least had a way of making a living afterwards. But it's that kind of snap decision you may have to make sometime. And they made a good decision to pack what they could in 10 minutes and go. And that saved their life. And people who were too late making those decisions in their same town, many, many perished.
Yeah, and I'm sure that the importance of making that call is just as important in a fire situation like that or a flood situation. I mean, it's doesn't really matter the disaster itself. There's many different disasters that have the ability to get to a point of criticality. So the important part is being able to move with swiftness if you've all of a sudden realized that critical point's been hit and to get to a different place. So all right, having a plan B sounds very important. I want to ask you one question back to to where to locate in the house. You had mentioned, try to get into a room that's structurally sound, try to avoid windows. I've heard for a lot of different types of disasters, you want to be in an interior room with as few windows as possible. Do you have an opinion on where in the house that room is? In other words, I've heard, sometimes find get in the basement if you can. But to your point about being able to leave the house quickly, are there also downsides about being in a basement that could get suddenly flooded or get, if the house begins to collapse, it might be hard to get out of the basement. Do you have a point of view on that?
This is where the flexibility and the gut feel comes in, and maybe we'll talk about the pit of the stomach exercise. But there is no one rule. Certainly, in tornadoes, people have survived them by laying down in bathtubs. But of course, I'm telling you to fill your bathtubs with water, so after the hurricane, you can use them. Well, if everything's falling apart around you, if you've got a good fiberglass stall, or a tiled shower where they put a concrete bed for the tile, then that's probably your safest bet there. That if you've got a good shower stall that's got a concrete bed and not just a sheetrock bed around it, then that you'd be very protected there. So it's a real judgment call. I mean, basements have typically been the safe places in houses. Richard Branson just weathered the storm with 13 house guests in his concrete bunker style wine cellar, while his, big mansion was broken up all around him. So, in his case, the basement didn't flood, and they were safe and sound in the basement, while, things were flying through windows and busting up walls up above their head. So, it's a judgment call, and use your judgment and use your gut, because sometimes the brain thinks one thing, and there's an. I believe that each and every one of us has this inner compass that's been built into it. Call it our spiritual DNA. It's built into us, and the people in our ancestors who didn't have that, well, they got eaten by the saber-toothed tiger, or they got killed in the battlefield, and so natural selection meant that people who had that survived. And so I think it's born and built into each and every one of us, and it can see around the corner and guide you when your brain mind can't make a good decision because it doesn't have the right information on it on hand. And just to give you an example of this is Elizabeth Hyke's wonderful book Initiation. She was a very she was a sculptor and sort of an enlightened yogi master in the latter part of her life. But in the younger part of her life, she was a renowned sculptor. And during World War II, she and her husband had a villa, and it was a big, strong place, and it provided great refuge for a number of families as the Allies were closing in and bombing Germany. And one day, she got this inner message that she had to leave, and she had to leave now. And everybody who stayed, the women were raped and the men were murdered, and so it was pretty horrible for whoever stayed in the villa. And she and half the people followed her when she got the message to leave, and half the people stayed. And so that's a case where the rational mind says, well, it's been safe here all along, we should just stay here. But the intuitive message said, it's been safe, but it's not safe tonight. You got to leave. You want to save your life, you got to leave now.
It's a great story, and it parallels something that we talk a lot about at Peak Prosperity called situational awareness. And I think this is a great example of it. And a lot of people who have served in the military are particularly familiar with this, but it's just always having sort of a real-time beat on what's going on around you and not taking anything for granted and continually updating your assessment of what's going on. It sounds like you're saying, clearly, as things are shifting during a disaster, do that and listen to your gut as much, if not even sometimes more than your head, because you've got some evolutionary radar in there that's picking up on things that maybe even your conscious mind isn't.
That's correct. Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. Now, you got to distinguish between the voice of fear and this inner radar. When the voice of fear will tend to flip-flop, it's thinking this, maybe I should do this, maybe I should do that. It's going this way, it's going that way, it's going crazy. When it's the inner radar telling you, it's kind of steady and unwavering, and it's not going to change its mind. It just simply knows. So you try to practice getting in touch with that, because if you listen to the wrong thing, they could just put you right into the jaws of disaster.
All right. Well, here let's switch here to. I think I sidetracked you from talking about the aftermath. You and I had joked before the podcast. You know, there's prepping and then there's posting, which is after the storm has happened. There's still a lot of things to be aware of, some of which can put you at great risk if you ignore them. Let's talk a little bit about that. What are some of the key things people need to be conscious of, aware of, or focused on? After the rain stops, the clouds part, or whatever the disaster is, after the acute threat is gone. I know that you've written a lot about flooding and some of the particularly nasty potential aftermaths of that, but what are some of the things people should be most focused on?
I'd say probably, especially with flooding, the two big things is going to be waterborne diseases and keeping yourself healthy in the aftermath. And that people are stressed, they're often cold, they're wet, they don't have the normal food they have, they have no normal comforts, and then the water supplies are totally polluted. And so you'll have raw sewage coming down the rivers, and you'll have the public water treatments are polluted and not working. So having the ability to purify water for yourself and your family is super critical. And it's so important that I'd like to have multiple backups in my go bag. So I've got a field serviceable water filter. I like the MSR and Katadyn ones that are backcountry standards around the world, and they're field serviceable because they've got a carbon cartridge in the core and an outer ceramic shell in the cartridge, and you can, when they plug up, you can take them out and scrub the outside layer off with a little Scotch-Brite green scrubby, and then put them back together and be going again. And they'll filter out all the bacterial protozoa, the protozoa and the bad bacteria out of your drinking water, so you can stay healthy. I like to have things on hand like a colloidal silver generator, so I can make colloidal silver. Now, 2,000 years ago, Alexander the Great didn't know anything about germ theory, but he knew that if he stored water for his troops in silver urns, then the troops stayed healthy. And a soldier in the battlefield that's vomiting and having diarrhea and vomiting isn't good for much. He's going to be a dead soldier. And keeping his battlefield soldiers healthy was very important. It turns out that tiny charged silver particles have this almost magical property of being toxic to all known bacteria, all known pathogenic bacteria, but not toxic to the good probiotic bacteria in your gut. So apparently, the extra thick cellular wall that protects your probiotic bacteria from stomach acids also protects them from the silvers that penetrate the cell walls and kill the normal, the bad bacteria. Now, another big thing that people don't think about that much is mold. And toxic mold in flooding situations is an extreme worry. I learned about this the hard way. In the early 2000s, I moved to Maui and I was a green builder. And we had the bad luck of renting a home that had a toxic black mold infestation hidden within the walls. And the first year we were there was no problem. The second year was the wettest winter in 100 years. Whole bunch of Kona wind storms drove blinding rains onto the normally dry side of the island and flooded things out, including our half basement. And suddenly my wife started getting really bad migraines, and my mother-in-law, I came home one day and she's lying in the bed saying, "I don't know what's going wrong with me. I can barely move. I feel like I'm dying." Well, it turned out she was dying. She didn't die, but she was close. And then my wife got sick and followed in her footsteps a few days later. And it was from this deadly black mold in the walls that the rains had brought out called Stachybotrys. And we learned the hard way too, that just we tried cleaning it off of everything. We moved, but just bringing our stuff with us recontaminated the places we moved to. And once she was nailed by this mold, she was like a canary in the mine. Anytime she got around it, even things that wouldn't bother other people would just take her down. And one of the side effects of this long term is cancer. And 9 years later, she died of cancer. So she recovered from the mold, but she struggled with ongoing issues from the mold for the next 9 years, and then got a blood bone cancer and died from that. So this is an extremely serious issue, and it masquerades often. People, it's like mold symptoms are not something like you got measles. You can look and say, oh, he's got measles. The mold is more like, yeah, you're getting migraines, you have sinus problems continually, you feel weak, you feel nauseous. In her case, she started seeing these bruises on her body. It was really severe, and it looked like she'd been beaten with chains. And the doctors, she said to the doctor, "Do you think mold could be doing this?" And the doctor said, "Oh no, trust me. This is at Kaiser in Maui." And they said, "Oh no, mold can't do that." And then we're looking on the internet, and we saw pictures of Staph aureus poisoning. And she said, "That's it. That's what I got." So we had to fly to Oahu to find a mold specialist to test her, and he said, yeah, he called us up and said, hey, you got Staphylococcus in the bloodstream really bad, and get out of the place you're in right now. A couple of weeks from now, your wife will probably be dead, because the next stage after this hemorrhaging under the skin was brain and lung hemorrhaging followed by death. So this is a really serious thing, and one person may be totally fine or appear to be fine, like it's just their system is strong and it's not getting it, and then maybe your kid is getting it sick, or maybe your wife is getting sick, and so it's insidious. It's very hard to diagnose, but know that if it smells musty, musty equals mold. And if you see mold growing on stuff, and if you've got a flood, you're gonna have mold. So, and I just published a took an excerpt from my book When Disaster Strikes and published it on my website, When Tech Fails Today. So I've got some really good tips on recognizing mold and mediating mold and how to know if you've got to get a professional in there. But I'm just telling you, pay attention to my wife's story. This mold thing is really serious and can cause long-term health problems and just totally take you down if you're not careful around it.
Well, Matt, first let me extend my deepest sympathies for what you and your wife went through. It's a heartbreaking story, and I'm sorry that your expertise has to be colored by that personal tragedy. But if anything, good comes out of it. I hope that you're reaching people both through your own work and through interviews like this, where you're putting that risk on people's radar that might otherwise not have known to look for it, and maybe helping people avoid getting placed in a similar situation. We'll definitely link to that guide that you just mentioned about mold and how to look for it and defend against it. Are there any quick big takeaways from that that you'd want to mention right here on the podcast?
Yeah, if you've been flooded, you're going to have mold.
Okay,
And
and
so,
sorry to interrupt, but we know that there's been, I think, close to 100,000 homes in Houston that have been flooded. So we know at least
right.
there's a whole bunch of households and probably a bunch more soon to be in Florida.
So you're going to have to strip everything down to the studs and then treat it. And you don't want to do what the owners, this backstory in the house we rented in Maui was that the owners, a couple of owners back before the ones we rented from, had gone on vacation in Bali for a month. And during that time, they had a sprinkler system in the house. Something set the sprinkler system off. And they came back, it was wall-to-wall black mold. So they did the unlicensed contractor thing where they kind of stripped stuff down and repainted and cleaned up and new carpets and this and that. And everything seemed fine. But it was hidden there in the walls, just waiting for another wet opportunity to really burst forth. And the prior owner of the house had made the downstairs half basement his office. And after 15 months in the house, he fell dead in the toilet. He was found dead by his wife in the toilet. And so when we moved in, they were stripping and gutting the downstairs half basement, and the workmen said, "Hey, this is a real mold pit. And I hope nobody's going to live down here." And we said, "No, it's just going to be our office and a guest room." And it was all cleaned up pretty and nice, and new carpets and everything smelled fine. We didn't give it much thought because I've never dealt with that stuff before. So it's serious. It's got to be done right. If you do a halfway job, you've probably thrown all of your money away, and it's going to come back and haunt you. It's got to be remediated fully. And you got to be really careful about saving furniture or saving anything. And some molds, if the mold was making you sick when you remediated, then you got to be really, really careful because there's still going to be some of it there. You got to use dehumidifiers, keep the humidity under 50% all the time to prevent it from coming back. I mean, there's a whole bunch of steps on there that we've taken, and it's serious, and it takes, once it's gotten a foothold in the house, it takes a continuing nonstop effort to keep it from becoming so serious that it takes your health down in the long run. And you might be fine with it for a year or two, and then you might succumb later on and not really even understand it's the mold doing it to you.
Wow. Just in our last couple of minutes here, Matt, one, I know that there's just volumes and volumes of advice and specific guidance that you give about specific type of items to put in your 72-hour kit, in your deep pantry and all the other parts of your planning for both disasters, emergencies, but also just for resilient living. We'll provide links to those on the site here because there's just not enough time in a single interview to go through all of the material that you present in your various different works. We talk about the physical and material things that you can get in advance of a disaster. We didn't address too much in this podcast here. The sort of more intangibles, things that we refer to at Peak Prosperity as social capital, meaning how you relate and interact and can be there in support of and ask for support from the people in your community during these type of times. And I think maybe that might be an interesting topic for a future discussion with you. But I did just want to flag it really briefly because I'd love to get your high level thoughts about it, particularly because you made that great comment earlier about tragedies bringing out the worst in some, but the best in most. And what's nice is we certainly had an example of the former in the immediate aftermath of Katrina, where things devolved so quickly and so poorly there in New Orleans. But we've also seen in the case of Harvey, many, many more stories of the latter, where people were out there, neighbor helping neighbor. Great stories of heroism and selflessness and charity in terms of people, rescuing neighbors and opening their homes to strangers, and the Cajun Navy going out there and saving elderly people from flooded rest homes, and just many, many, many examples. And also, it's interesting just to tack onto this. We did a podcast about a year or two back with Sebastian Junger, the author of A Perfect Storm or The Perfect Storm, as well as a number of other books. And one of the books he had written was after he had spent over a year in Afghanistan in a hot zone with a U.S. platoon, and was just really taken with the bonds that people form under adversity. And he ended up writing a book called Tribe, coming out of that, which really talked about how we are fully expressed as humans when we're operating amongst a tribe where everybody has everybody's back, and you're collectively existing to overcome some sort of existential adversity. And I think, not that we ever wish for these disasters to happen, but as you said earlier, these tragedies give us an opportunity to kind of bring out the best in ourselves. And in many ways, it's sort of how we're wired to behave. So with all that, anything on that topic of being in service to those around you during these types of disasters?
Well, certainly, I think the classic image of the lone wolf, go it by yourself survivalist is that most of us would not do well in that. And most of those people, if they're around others, someone meaner and tougher and better organized will come and take all their good stuff, cool stuff away. So we do much better in groups, and we can share resources, we can watch each other's backs. No one can stay awake 24/7. We're much better in groups, we're much more powerful in groups. And so if you have, some people say, well, I just don't have any money for all of this stuff. But if you're young and stronger and you have skills, then develop work on your skills. And other people say, well, maybe I'm older and I have the money for it, but I'm just not very strong. And so in that case, think about strategic partnerships. You know, who think about teaming up with your neighbors in your community. You know, develop a network. And because that's really where the strength lies. And to be honest with you, I mean, I've got store food and stuff, but if one of my neighbors is starving, I'm not going to be able to say no to them. I mean, that's just unrealistic, which means that my food probably won't last nearly as long as I'd hope it would. But I'd better have good foraging skills, because when it's gone, if I need to, I'll be out foraging. But it's just let it, think of it as an opportunity to be a part of a tribe, to be a part of a bigger, kinder, gentler world that hopefully will come out of this adversity. And I really do believe that the world, after all of this is said and done, when we pick up the pieces and put it together and get our world on a sustainable track, it will be a kinder, gentler, more sustainable, more peaceful world. What we go through between here and that point in the future, how hellish it gets, or maybe we get smart and make the transition without having to be that bad. I don't know. But I certainly would love to be a part of that vision for a future where we're all working together for a sustainable, peaceful, wonderful world. And, let the disasters be a part of heading for that vision.
We're very well said, Matt, and I completely agree. And it reminds me of the saying that this isn't specific to emergencies of the type we're talking about, but just trials in general. But the saying says you can't control what happens to you in life, but you can control how you react to it. And I think that's very much what you're saying, where we can't prevent these disasters from happening, but we certainly can control our response to them, and use those as ways to improve ourselves and bring ourselves closer with those around us. So with that said, Matt, thank you so much for your time and for your expertise here. And I think it's going to be very directly and very directly relevant and practical to many of the people listening to this. Certainly our best wishes from Peak Prosperity to those that are facing down Irma and Jose and potentially even the hurricane, the Katia, which is formed in the Gulf now. It looks like it's going to be a very active year, just for hurricanes alone. And of course, yesterday, or I guess actually this morning, we had the biggest earthquake in 100 years in Mexico. So for whatever reason, it seems like Mother Nature is trying to make our lives more interesting these days. But we understand that there's a human cost that comes to a lot of these tragedies, and our thoughts are with everybody listening here. I'd also like to briefly reiterate that we're going to be linking to all the resources that Matt mentioned during the podcast. I also want to remind our listeners that we have a very robust both disaster preparedness, but also sort of a general life preparedness guide at peakprosperity.com called the What Should I Do Guide. And you can access that at peakprosperity.com/whatshouldido or peakprosperity.com/WSID. One of the chapters in that guide is around building social capital of the type that Matt and I were talking about there near the end. So if you're looking for ideas on how to do that, that's got a lot of specific best practices to recommend. And with that, Matt, again, I want to thank you again for your time. I'd really love to have you back on the podcast again in the future, and perhaps even in an upcoming webinar that's dedicated to general preparation and resilience, where we can let our audience ask direct questions of you in real time. Would you be open to that?
Oh, sure. I'd love to be a part of that.
All right, great. Well, I'm sure people will chime in the comments into their level of interest, but I'm sure it's going to be quite high. Thanks everybody for listening. Thank you again, Matt. And Matt, we'll talk to you again soon.
Oh, you're welcome. Been a pleasure, and I like to close with my motto, and I ask everyone to do their best to change the world and do their best to be ready for the changes in the world. And thank you so much for having me on today.
All right, Matt, very well said, and a real pleasure to have you. Take care.